This 915 slot across the board has been kind of science, religion, ethics in various ways, and the topic today is truth-telling, and we want to deal with that topic in general, but also specifically in relation to doctor-patient relationships. And my name is Jim, and I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. Dave here is a radiologist in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and Kirk is in dermatology in Lake Oswego also, and Fred is in rehabilitation medicine. Is that the correct term in California, Santa Cruz? Is it? But you,
San Jose.
Okay. And so I'd like to say some things about truth-telling. And maybe maximum 15 minutes, I guess. And Dave and Kirk and Fred will each give a five-minute pitch from their point of view. So we'll have about 30 minutes presentation, and then we'll have conversation. And feel free to break in any time for clarification, but we won't have free-for-all discussion until we get something out on the table. I guess that I think that... maybe the one thing that I want to say about truth-telling is that it seems to me that it's an incredibly complex rather than a simple thing. The story is going around about Jimmy Carter, that when he was a little kid, he chopped down the peanut tree. I know peanuts don't grow on trees, but cut down the peanut tree. And his father came and said, Jimmy, did you cut down the peanut tree? And Jimmy Carter said, Daddy, I cannot tell a lie. Maybe I did, and maybe I didn't. when he says, I will never tell you a lie, that is either very naive, or it's very clever, or it's very dumb, it seems to me, because there is no way that anyone can run this country without, at the very least, withholding information, which is a kind of, so we're going to have to talk about that, the kind of less than telling the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, etc. He says that, I think, in the post-Watergate time, because we've had enough of outright lying and cover-up and so on. But even that, I think, is very complex. Woodward and Bernstein have made a reputation and a fortune about telling how the Watergate people lied, but if you have read reviews of that book and that film, you know that a lot of the principals are saying that Woodward and Bernstein are lying about what they said and did. I spent a whole morning with Ken Dalberg, who happens to be a member of Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, and who plays a minor role in that book and that film. If you saw the film, you remember that he's the guy in Minneapolis who they called from Florida, and it was his check that finally cracked the thing open. And he did have $10,000 in cash in his golf bag and all kinds of stuff like that. He's a fundraiser for the committee to reelect the president. But when they called him in Minneapolis on the in the film, he hangs up, and then he calls back later, very, very upset and disturbed, and you get the idea that he has been found out, and now he's just whispering this stuff. According to Dalberg, and I don't know him well, but I was convinced by his story, Mrs. Piper of Piper Jaffray Hopwood is a brokerage firm, had been kidnapped the day before. The next-door neighbor They were very upset, very suspicious of all phone calls and stuff like that. He hung up, he called the Washington Post and confirmed who they were, he called them back, and the innuendos in the portrayal of that phone call in the film, according to Dahlberg, were, you know, an outright lie. So the truth, again, it seems to me, is somewhat complicated, difficult to get at. People are for after the FBI and the CIA. I don't know personally how you can run a country of this size without an intelligence organization. I don't see how you can have an intelligence organization without covert operations. I don't see how you can have covert operations without lying. That's built into the reality of things. I think that that doesn't mean that people ought to tell, quote, outright lies. It means that telling the truth, I think, is a complex thing. Classified information is a kind of lying because it's a withholding of information. At any rate, it seems to me it's worth looking at. We have in our legal system procedures by which we try to get at the truth. We don't just assume that people tell the truth. We say, do you tell the truth? And we ask them to swear that they'll tell the truth, and not only the truth, but the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then we ask them to raise the right hand and swear on the Bible. Then we have perjury laws, and we have cross-examination, and then the jury votes on whether or not the person told the truth. It's an incredibly complex thing. Let me mention three streams of thinking about truth-telling, just to get some hooks on the wall. The first is what could be called an absolutist position. That is to say that the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth must always be told by everyone to everyone. Truth is an absolute. My grandfather lived with us for a number of years, and he happened to have perfect pitch. After the service on Sunday, he would go up and tell the soloist that she was off key. And on the way home in the car, my mother would say, "Dad, what do you have to do that for?" He said, "Well, I have to tell the truth." I mean, if he didn't tell her that, he thought he would be telling a lie, because she would think that he thought that she was on pitch, and she wasn't. So he had to say that, or he wouldn't be telling the truth. Well, that's an absolutist position on telling the truth, and it's held by many people, but it was formulated, I think, in a classic way by Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher, who talked a great deal about truth-telling, and who said that we must always, everyone must always tell the truth in every situation. And he formulated the rule of universalizability. And universalizability means that one should always act in such a way that he or she can will that action as a universal law for all humankind. It's a sophisticated version of the "what if everybody did that" argument. Okay, so Kant says that you must tell the truth. Someone comes in the way, he actually uses this illustration. Someone comes in the door and says, "I've come here to rape your wife. Is she at home?" The only proper response to that is, "Yes, third door to the left." Because you must not ever entertain the question of expediency. You must never entertain the question of the consequences, the result of your action. You must not ask, does this do harm or good? You must only ask, is it right? There's a question about, there's a difference between whether something is right and whether something is good. If you say whether this is good, that means good for whom, good in what way, and then you start to calculate consequences. Kant says you must never ask whether it's good, you only ask if it's right. And your obligation is not just to that individual or to yourself. Your obligation is to the whole human race. And you cannot will lying to be a universal law for all humankind, because then lying wouldn't even work. You know, if people didn't tell the truth, a lie wouldn't work, because no one would believe anybody and the whole social fabric would disintegrate. Right? Okay, so that's an absolutist position. Okay, secondly, there is what can be called a utilitarian position on truth that also has a long, long history, goes back to Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and other people. And a utilitarian view says that you don't ask what's right, but you ask what's good. What matters is not whether or not your words fit this set of facts. What matters is whether your words are going to accomplish a good end. And so in a caricatured form, this is the so-called Jesuit, although that's a caricature too, end justifies the means argument. That is, if a lie will bring about a good end, it's okay, because what's important is that end, okay, the consequence. And so this was worked out by a whole bunch of people, and they talk about calculating the consequences, okay? So that, for instance, if you withhold information, if you tell a partial truth, if you sugarcoat the truth, in order to bring about a good result, that's okay. In fact, you may even want to call that telling the truth. One other notion of truth-telling, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he was in prison, was being interrogated by the Nazis, and they were pressing him for names of people who were in on the July 20th plot on Hitler's life, and he was lying his head off to them. He had read Kant, he knew well the absolutist position, and he worried about that, and he wrote a little essay, What is Meant by Telling the Truth? So a little story about a girl in third grade. A teacher says to the girl, is it true that your father comes home drunk every day? And the girl says, no, he does not. Then Bonhoeffer goes on to discuss that and says, the father does come home drunk every night. But what is meant by telling the truth? What's important? And he says, it is not important that this girl's words match up with the fact of her father coming home drunk every night. What's important is the protection of the sanctity of her home. Bonhoeffer winds up saying the teacher told a lie by putting the girl into the kind of situation that she did. The girl told the truth by protecting the sanctity of her home. Now, that's very tricky. Huh? And that leads into all kinds of possibility for rationalizing. Bonhoeffer draws on the fact that Jesus says, I am the truth. So the truth then becomes not a sentence and some so-called facts, but the truth becomes a way of putting into words what is real about the situation. That can be called situationism. It can also be called the coherence theory of truth. And people talk about the correspondence theory of truth, where words correspond to facts. They also talk about the coherence theory of truth, where a word or a sentence or a paragraph captures in those words the reality of the situation. And I suppose insofar as one could talk about a piece of art or a film or some kind of statement from the theater as really true, or you say, gee, this place is gorgeous, that is not a sentence that you can match up, you know, words and facts, but it may nevertheless be true if it gathers together all kinds of data and expresses that reality in some kind of legitimate way. So we have an absolutist notion of truth, we have a utilitarian notion of truth, both of which are kind of correspondence theories, and we have a coherence theory of truth. Well, it obviously has implications all over the place, but one area in which that has implications is in terms of doctor-patient relationships. And I guess that I'm going to leave that there, and let's hear from Dave and Kirk and Fred, And we have some time then for conversation. Anything that you want to say about truth-telling?
Well, I don't think we can really define truth or lying. Maybe Jim can. What is a partial truth? That's also a partial lie. My primary experience with patients has been with cancer patients in radiation treatment. And in a few minutes, I can only give you what my ideas are. And I think these people should be told that they have cancer, what their situation is. But in one respect, you're not telling them the truth because you're not giving them all the gory details. You can offer them some hope, and I think you should, that you're, perhaps you can't cure them, but you will help them, you'll be with them, you will do what you can for their pain as problems come up. I would say that 95 or more percent of patients you can handle this way and should be handled this way. There is a small percent of patients that are emotionally so unstable that they cannot handle the information and it would kind of blow them apart. And they're not always easy to pick out, but sometimes you have to make a value judgment in their situation. I had a chance to work with patients that both knew their situation and did not, being in a private hospital. Some of our patients were referred by private physicians who the idea 20 to 40 years ago and maybe on before, and why I don't know, was that you didn't tell the patients. You didn't tell them they had cancer. And some of these older doctors would refer patients to us with specific instructions that they had not told their patients and we were not to. So we got a good grip on seeing patients that had been told and had not. There was a rather remarkable difference between the two groups. The patients who've been told, some of them just sort of accepted, but very, very many of them just become tremendous patients. They have a greatest acceptance. They understand that you're trying to help them. They don't complain. They're appreciative. When you can't help them, they seem to understand and say, you know, don't feel bad about it. They have a certain peace and acceptance that was really inspiring. I know several patients that I got very close to because of the way they handled their cancer and they handled their dying situation. On the other hand, the patients who aren't told are frequently the extreme complainers. They're unhappy. Why can't you do more for this pain I have? The restrooms are dirty. Nitpicking everything, and they're after the nurses, they're after the secretaries, they're complaining because they have to wait. They're really difficult, and they make their own situation worse, of course, because everybody reacts to that kind of a person and kind of, you know, shoves them off on somebody else or tries to avoid them. So I would say that truth, in quotes, is essential for the vast majority of patients, and they do very well under it.
Have you ever told the patient the truth and then found that they have not heard it later?
Yes, this happens. fairly frequently, actually. You've been in the night before and you've told them they have cancer, and you can't operate on them, but you're going to give them radiation treatment and try to slow down the growth and so on. And the next day, you'll talk to the husband, and he'll say, "My wife said she just, has a pneumonia." And she believes that. I mean, down deep she knows, but she won't admit it.
I think we'll get these statements out before we have general discussion.
I've talked on many medical programs before, but I've never followed a systematic theologian, so... I imagine also that not all of you have been consumers of medical care, and where truth-telling might come into the process, where it could be abused or misunderstood from one party or the other. And I thought that I might just take the blackboard and... let's see, does that... And I thought it might be instructive to just sort of go through the medical process, because in some time frame or another, you and your doctor, or your doctor and someone that you know, will go through this process. And essentially the process starts with a person who has a problem, who they recognize that they feel sick or that they need some help of some sort. And then there's really the point of contact or entry into the system in which the person seeks help and finds it someplace. And that point of contact could be in a doctor's office, it could be in a free clinic, it could be at a roadside accident, it could occur under a variety of circumstances. Under normal circumstances, there's some dialogue that takes place, some history taking of a sort. And the veterinarian, of course, doesn't have the benefit of this. If a physician cannot speak the language of the sick person, you may lack the benefit of dialogue. Frequently then there's an examination. And the doctor attempts to assess the overall status of the person, their vision, their hearing, their state of sensibility, the size and the character of their organs and so on. And then frequently at this point there will be some sort of a preliminary impression established. The doctor tries to get some gist as to where we're going from here. I've never heard an exact number of all the diseases that man is heir to, but I think 10 or 15,000 might be a conservative number. And so you need to find out where this game is going to be played and in which ballpark you're going to be dealing. So you have a preliminary impression usually at this point. Now's the opportunity to carry out some sort of laboratory tests. A sample of blood might be taken, a sample of tissue might be taken, some diagnostic x-rays may be required. So this is a time for laboratory study. And then hopefully the kind of information that's gained from that will lead to a diagnosis. I'm running out of room here. And hopefully this will be a much more firm and a defensible diagnosis than we had back here, and then we get into a phase of management. But all of these things go through the relationship that a doctor and patient establishes. They can take place in a very short time period. If there's an acute medical emergency, sometimes the process will really take months to get to the bottom line. Let's take an example and kind of fish our way through it and see what happens. Let's say the person feels hot, recognizes that they've lost weight, 6 or 8 pounds in the last 2 weeks, and has some red bumps on their shins, some red bumps on the legs. And so they come to a physician and make contact and tell of these things. Let's say also that this person in the back of their mind is terribly frightened. They think that they have cancer. And it really took a great deal of courage to compose themselves and to present themselves to find out, because they remember that Aunt Minnie, who had breast cancer just before she died, she had red lumps all over her skin, and this was a very serious thing that the person has in the back of their mind, they're very frightened about. And so they come in, and she says, well, I'm hot, and I've lost weight, and I've got these bumps on my leg. And at this point, I'm thinking about the differential diagnosis of red bumps on the leg. Okay, this, you know, I should have a column here. This is what I'm thinking. This is what's going through my mind. And then we have the patient, who really should be thought of in another column, who has a whole different series of expectations and perceptions than I have. And as a matter of fact, the differential diagnosis of red bumps on the legs can be an allergic reaction in about 90% of cases. It can be a fungal infection in 3 or 4 or 5% of cases. It can actually be tumors, mycosis fungoides in 1% or less, certain types of leukemia in 1% or less. And so you get to a certain point here. I haven't made up my mind yet at this point, but the patient might think that I have, and might come out with the tantalizing, is it cancer, doctor? And I know by that question and the way it's said, I get a sense or a feeling for that person, and they really want to know the answer, is it cancer, doctor? And I've got the odds in mind already. It's 2% chance. And I think what I do in a situation like that is not to tell all the truth. I'll try to temporize, if I can, with the person and say, let's wait and see. But more often than not, I'll choose a phrase like, it is almost certainly not. And if I feel gutsy, I may even say that certainly it's not, depending on what I think that patient needs. Because by golly, in my experience, every person is different than every other person. And every setting, every office setting or emergency setting is really just a little bit different than everyone. And I guess I must select and choose the measure and degree of truth that I use in going through the process. Well, it turns out that our patient really has an allergy. That impression is confirmed by a biopsy of tissue. I can now talk about that diagnosis, and we get down to management. I'll just say one more thing. Let's say the management requires the use of a medication or a drug that the person needs to take by mouth. If I were to go to the physician's desk reference or to other appropriate medical literature and look at the side effects that could result from the use of that drug, and if I were required to read the patient and give them full disclosure and read them their full rights, I may have to say that, yes, this is an extraordinarily safe drug that I'm giving you. Maybe only 3 people in 100 or 2 people in 100 will have a reaction to this drug. But these reactions could be cholestatic jaundice, your liver is going to sort of fill up with bile and your eyes are going to turn yellow, your kidneys could fail, you could get a skin rash, you could develop angioedema and choke to death. All of these things have been reported for this drug. It's been used safely in 50,000 to 60,000 cases. That becomes an extraordinary task, and one which I'm pleased we don't have to do in great detail, because I think our patients wouldn't take, in fact, you wouldn't take aspirin if you knew all the things that had happened to people who have taken aspirin. And yet, if you get your orientation straight, I think you can realize that of the 200 and some million people in this country, probably 180, 190 million have taken aspirin, and most of them safely. Well, let me stop there, but I think there are degrees of truth that we encounter. And I think the physician carefully picks his way along and tries to individualize.
Thank you, Fred.
I was just going to say a few words to it, if I could sort of step back for a minute and philosophize a little bit. I too haven't followed any theologians in this kind of a discussion, but I guess since that's the opportunity, I can't at least resist that a little bit. What I was going to say too is, in thinking through this subject, is
we've already obviously got, to me, some utilitarian notions of truth going here. I think that's clear. Yeah.
Right, because that's what I wanted to is, what is the truth? And I think to answer that, you obviously have to realize that both the listener as well as the hearer, I mean the person who's saying it as well as the person who's receiving the truth message, have a different perception of what the reality is, and they're going to have a different definition of it. And I think in most situations in medicine, when patients are asking us, doc, tell me the truth. I want it straight. You know, I want to know what's the matter with me, what's going to happen to me. Really, the majority of time, you could say that the truth isn't really known. And the doctor is going to be making a judgment. He can tell you the truth as he sees it, but it's not really an absolute truth. In the sense that he's a human being who is subject to imperfection, and his judgment of what is wrong down here on the diagnosis may not be accurate. And even more importantly than that, his ability to make an entirely truthful, that is, an entirely accurate prediction of the future is obviously imperfect. So it becomes then very difficult, I think, for the doctor to try and answer that question of what is the truth. Then I was going to go on to say that in this statement of the ends justifying the means, if we say that the end of most of medicine, and I think Jim referred to that, is to, in the Hippocratic Oath or whatever, to reduce suffering, and we could turn around maybe and put that in theological terms too, is perhaps maybe the greatest of these is love, if that's what you're really after, then I think a lot of us would say that's the primary goal in your relationship to the patient, rather than answering some kind of an absolutism as to what is the truth, especially when what that truth really is not absolutely known. At least that would be my opinion on that. And it does really involve a judgment. The other judgment is what I think you referred to, Kirk, was in regard to making a judgment about specific patients as how much they want to know. One of the things that I use in my own practice in dealing with people is I do a lot of work with traumatic spinal cord injury patients who may break their neck or their back and be faced with a lifelong problem of disability. And yet there's nothing wrong with their mind, of course, and they need to know. And we feel that they, in fact, do need to know. And they're always asking us, well, what's going to happen? What is my prognosis for the future? And one of the guidelines I think you have to use, and it's not a matter of withholding the truth, but first of all, you often don't really know, although you can predict with a fair amount of accuracy. But the second way of looking at that is, how much is the patient really ready to hear? In other words, where's his mind at, and what he's ready to hear on the second day after his injury, or 2 months down, or 2 years down, may be quite different. So what I tend to say is somewhat a reflection of what the patient is asking. So if he comes out and directly asks you a question, then you try and, in fact, give him the answer that he's looking for without elaborating on and on of all the implications, as I think some of the other people said, relative to drugs or some of the complications that can later handle with cancer. Maybe it's a little bit like, and I hate to use a legalistic analogy, but like you said, you get on the witness stand and say, this promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. In fact, when you're there, you only answer the question the attorney asks you, and you don't editorialize beyond that. And I think there's somewhat of that true in a patient when they're asking you, what's the matter, or what's going to happen to me in the future. And that's why you get answers like when patients, even with cancer patients, they say, how long have I got, doc? You know, all right, now that you've told them in a nice way that, yes, the tumor that they took out and looked under in the biopsy, it's cancer. You may want to leave it at that. On the other hand, the patient may not let you. You see, they may want, but doc, what does that mean? How long do I have? I want to know so I can plan my life with my family and get things said with my Lord, whatever that I have to do. And so then what do you tell them? You have to tell them the truth as you know it, or you have to interpret the facts of their situation as best you know, but you can't really tell them whether it's going to be 2 months or 2 years or 20 years. You can tell them maybe, all right, your chances of making it 5 years are 2%, okay, and then that's maybe a figure that they can handle, but that's as close to the truth as you can come. And that's kind of what I do also with prognosis, is try to give people the facts such as the facts are known, and let them make their own interpretations, in a sense, of that as to how they want to act on those facts. And by doing that, I think what you clearly do is you leave people some hope that I think Kirk referred to also. And I think this is extremely important if you're talking about at least diseases that are going to kill you in the near future. And I was just going to say, one of the other things people ask, you know, cancer, well, does that mean I'm going to die? Well, sure, it means you're going to die, but you're going to die anyway. I mean, whether you've got cancer or not, only the Lord is going to be able to answer that question. Let's see, I forgot my train of thought, I guess, when I got off on that for a minute. But I was talking about hope. But therefore, I do think if you can give people a certain amount of statistics or some odds in that sense, then they are going to take that. And that leaves them the option of saying, all right, a miracle can still happen. I can still get cured of my cancer. I can still get cured of my otherwise incurable paraplegia, etc. But let's not count on it. You know. And I think that's the important thing that I usually feel. In other words, start dealing with it. The chances are that you're not going to make it very long, whether it's 6 months or 2 years or whatever. That's probably irrelevant. But you at least have a time frame, but you don't cut them off. Because if you do, if you tell them, well, you're going to die in 6 months, they aren't going to, for one thing, I don't think most people will believe you. And they'll find another doctor and go see what he says, and then they'll try another one out, and they may go to Mexico because somebody down there has a drug that's going to cure your cancer, etc. And then that prevents them from really facing, I think, the issue that they have to deal with.
It would be lots of fun for us, I'm sure, to interact at this point. But I think we ought to just open it up. There are other medical people in the village. We just met you this morning at breakfast. I don't even know your name, but you're in radiology. And there are other medical people here. We're all at least potential consumers of medical care. And so there isn't a person here who doesn't, I think, have some interest in this question. I think that the crunch comes at the point of what some patients consider to be paternalism. That is to say, is the patient simply at the in the situation where the patient must disclose all the symptoms in as matter-of-fact a way as possible, but the doctor is always making these judgments? Is there some way that the patient can also enter into that judgment-making process? I think that's where the crunch comes, and I think there are a lot of patients who are making demands for information, what they would call truth-telling in a way that has not perhaps been, happened in the past. Well, it's wide open, and let's hear what anyone has to say.
I have a
say.
Question.
Yes.
The first doctor is Jim?
Dave.
I really liked your attitude.
Yeah.
When, how far, or what's the situation when family are involved? I mean, this happened in my family, where the doctor told, like, the husband, and he said, you know, my wife can't take it. So nobody told her, and she went on months and months and months. And like this morning, I was just reading an article about the woman that wrote on death and dying. And me, it would have been easier for me going to see her if she would have known. I know, but I mean, what is your on that? How much do you, myself, I want to know? I don't want anybody to.
Could I add a parenthesis there, just a footnote? I've heard a lot of people say that patients do know often, even though they're not told, and so it becomes a big game-playing thing. I'm just wondering, that's just a footnote to your comment.
Yeah.
In our county, we went through that 2 times, that's what I...
Yeah, well, this is true, what Jim says is, you know, most of these people do figure it out, although nobody's ever told them in so many words. Your question, that's a, you know, it's a really a tough situation. I think you, primarily you have to listen to the patient and go along with the patient's wishes. But I think you can try to influence the patient to either let you tell the rest of the family or have them do it. It's
isn't the other thing that you need to try and create a situation to read that patient out? I mean, like, take them in private away from the family and try and create an opportunity by which they can ask you if they're going to, without you having to take a club on the head and say, hey, do you know you got, you know, really know you got cancer and you're only going to make it for another 6 months? I mean, you don't want to say that to them. You know what I mean? On the other hand, if you can read them for the fact that it's really bothering them, it's really bugging them, they're anxious, they're whatever, they're just skirting the issue all around, but they really want to know, but they can't muster up the courage to directly ask you.
Everybody protecting everybody else.
Yeah, then create the opportunity and try and bring it out of them, but you want to try and feel them out, I think. Would you agree with that, Jim? Or
yeah.
Dave, I mean?
Yeah, I interject an absolutist kind of thing here. I think if you have, as a physician, the policy of always letting that word cancer come out. Now, I'm speaking from a regular therapy point of view, too. And in 5 years of doing this, I have never yet seen an adverse effect on patient or family. I've had people come to me, as this lady related, a husband or a son or someone saying, now protect mother, protect wife mm-hmm. from this knowledge. Please don't tell. And I always say, I won't treat unless this person knows what I'm treating, knows what to expect, and can deal with that. Now, that person may want to deal with it by rejecting the whole idea. And if that's their defense, that's fine. But that fact has to come out at least once. Now, what that means then is subject to interpretation. Does that mean I'm going to die? The patient is at liberty to decide whether they want to fasten on the 5% chance of life and look forward optimistically as you help them to do so, or whether they would prefer to look at it from the other end of the tube, if you like, and say, well, that means I'm going to die. I will prepare myself. And oftentimes, if the patient adopts that attitude, they do die and die sooner than you expect them to. But this brings up another point, too. We've talked a lot about the doctor and his responsibility to tell the truth to the patient, assuming that two things. The patient wants to know the truth all the time and expects the doctor to tell it. And number two, that the patient is always being truthful with the doctor. Now, when the patient comes, in your analogy, I forget your name, but dermatologist, when the patient comes because he's hurting someone, he may come all prepared to tell facts and accurate observations about what he's feeling and what he's thinking, if that's appropriate, usually it is. Or he may come feeling something entirely different from what you as physician assess as his problem. For example, a man may come saying, Doc, I have this physical problem, I'm impotent. And I've been this way for years and years, and I've gone to Dr. A, B, C, D, and E, and they have given me vitamins and potions and this and that and the other. Nothing has helped. Now, do you know anything to try? And so you immediately recognize that this is not a problem you can treat with vitamins, pills, and so forth and so on. And you talk to him about his personal life and his wife and so on. And pretty soon you suggest the wife come and talk to you together with husband. Let's see if we can get to this problem. And you find out they hate each other, and the man is terribly depressed and is talking about committing suicide, and that really, underneath this impotence problem, which is the thing we focus on, is the truth. Truth? Yeah, but let's not talk about that, because after that interview and after getting toward the, quotes, truth, he refuses to come back, and his wife won't have anything to do with getting at the truth. They go to Dr. What is it? F for pills and potions. Now, this applies to the same analogy in all kinds of things, including cancer, including rehabilitation problems, including prognosis, and so on. So we can't forget that the issue of truth in doctor-patient relationships has a lot to do with what the patient tells the doctor in the first place and what the patient may be trying to keep the doctor from finding out.
And partly how fine-tuned your ear is to pick up and listen and hear the real problem.
Sure, but then the obverse of that is, will the patient let you do anything for it if you do diagnose it? And often a patient will come to me and say, I really want to get this cancer cured, and I'll do anything you say. And superficially they do. But beneath that conscious level, they're doing everything they can to die of their disease. And I find that the truth is then the patient wants to die. So let's do all we can to keep them from doing that, but you know darn well you'll do the best.
Dr. Schatz.
I suppose when we go outside of the medical field too, and put all those of us who are lay people in the position the doctor is oftentimes, what do you do when you are asked to give a recommendation for a given person? There are 101 ways of giving recommendations. When I get one and I see it's loaded with superlatives, I immediately become suspicious. How do you tell the truth?
That has become a much more complicated problem since the court cases for open files. I write recommendations all the time, and I used to write those recommendations knowing that they were confidential. Now I have to write them knowing that the person about whom I'm writing is going to see that letter, and that's a whole different thing. Some schools have a waiver place where the person can check and waives his or her right to see that letter, and then I feel, okay, now I can
say the truth.
Well, yeah, but it's in any case, in either case, it's complicated, but I think the open files thing has further complicated that. What about placebos? Is that an issue in truth telling, or is that a myth? Don't doctors do that?
What is that?
Placebos. That is a sugar pill that has absolutely no medical importance, but may help to cure that person. Obviously, if one said, now I'm going to give you a sugar lump, it would not get the job done.
Right.
So the placebo demands, at the very least, withholding of information.
It reminds me that you have to realize that depending on what aspect of medicine you're talking about, but I think in general they say something like 30%, I think, or maybe 40% of most symptoms that people go to a doctor with will get better if nothing is done. Mm-hmm. You say, so if you give a placebo, you haven't got too bad an odds that it's going to work. And I don't think anybody who has a significant practice, in the more general practice, I suppose, the more true it is that doesn't use, in fact, placebos from time to time. And you can look at that as that's a good example of what's the truth, because the truth is you either think the problem is not too important and is going to get better by itself, but you're afraid to tell them that. you think it's something psychological, and by taking something that you think there's going to be a positive psychological benefit from that, which there certainly can be, that's what faith healers or all kinds of, I don't want to just say them, but all kinds of quacks, of course, can take advantage of the same thing that people choose, but they can't take that if you come from a position who's not supposed to do that.
The derivation of placebo is I will make happy.
Yes.
And a recent discussion that I was in on that was, who is being made happy, the physician who gets a placebo effect from a lot of drugs, or the patient, or both? But I think one has to appreciate that that a lot of the effect of any drug generates from the interaction of the sick person and the doctor, and you're right, 30-40% is still being quoted as and so one has to find out if any drug really has an effect on the disease, and therefore to find out which drugs are effective, there have to be double-blind control studies in which placebos are used.
Mm-hmm. There's a book I haven't read by the fellow who wrote 369 Days, or is it named Glasser or something, entitled The Body is the Hero. I don't know if anyone has read that or not, but the reviews that I've read, the pitch is about the body's own recuperative powers, and that one thing that a physician does is to try to allow the body to do its own work, which is kind of what you're saying. And it seems to me that that type of information to the, I don't know, I'm not pitching that particular book, but that type of information would be very, very helpful for doctor-patient relationships, so that the patient is really just by his own or her own body participating in the healing process.
And that, you know, that's something we all try to do is involve the patient in their own treatment. But the hard part is how to involve them psychologically, I guess, to evolve their mind. I mean, one way is to teach them the mechanics, we do that a lot, of course, in rehabilitation, because so much of that is they have to do so many body functions in new ways that we have to teach them all kinds of things in order to do. But you have to do that in almost any situation. I mean, even if you have a disease like insulin or diabetes, I mean, you have to take insulin for it. I'm sure everyone realizes that is a major training function to get them to learn how to take the insulin, how to give it, and understand their own disease. And they are going to be the best person to ever manage that, as opposed to a doctor. I mean, they have to do the managing of it themselves. They have to live. They have to manage their activity, their what they eat, their drug dosage, and all kinds of other things. And
getting back to patients that are terminally ill, like say with cancer. Lots of times you find out that really the fear isn't I'm going to die. It's the living before I die. I'm going to suffer this terrible agony. I'm going to cough up my guts all over the place. And if you can allay this kind of fear and say, yes, we can keep you comfortable.
What if you can't?
Yeah, what if you can't?
Most of the time, can't you keep them in relative? I don't know. I heard Dr. Lamberton from London, and he feels that by adjusting the medication, can truly keep people comfortable until the end, and it does not have to be this agonizing experience.
There comes a point, though, here we get into euthanasia considerations, because if you give enough drug to suppress that cough, that much drug kills the patient, and you know it as a physician, and you do it, maybe. But is that right?
There's a place called St. Christopher's Hospice in London that is simply designed for making the dying patient comfortable. And so they acknowledge the fact that those heavy dosages of drugs are going to cause that person to die sooner than, but that's the commitment of the whole place is not to extend life another month or two. The commitment of the place is to make that person comfortable in those life. Well, that raises massive issues, as you say. That's certainly a euthanasia-type question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is a comfortable patient, though, really a living patient? Mm-hmm. If they're all zonked out and out of it, you know, is that life?
Mm-hmm. He feels they are, the way he adjusts the drugs, they
I've heard of his work.
Alert. You know, he gives less times cortisone, which kind of reduces cerebral edema. So that is a meaningful kind of life. And he draws a distinction, which is a little hazy, of you abandon a treatment that is not successful, knowing that that may then cause the death of the patient rather than prolonging the life.
Yeah, I've heard of his work, and it almost sounds too good to be true is about all I can say about it.
The other thing I'd say about that is, too, you are taking the person out of, that you may be taking them out of their own life, situation, family, home, etc. Well, they would be, but what if their family lives 200 miles away? You know,
it's a smaller country, and that has also worked in with a home service situation where they will go home.
There are places in this country, I think, that I've heard in Minneapolis being constructed on that St. Christopher's Hospice model. Pardon me?
In Connecticut
also.
It's not self-supporting because the construct of our third-party and government-paid propositions will not allow this kind of thing to be self-supporting, if you get what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Cross won't pay for the kind of care that's necessary in this kind of a situation. So it's been limping along on special government grants and so on.
Huh.
It doesn't look like a viable kind of thing under our present funding structure.
Huh.
Which is another example of truth-telling, how many times physicians have to lie. That's an outward lie. in order to get health care paid for their patients. It happens all the time.
I'd like to expand just a little bit on the tying in the utilitarian versus the absolutist approach, and that's the way that you carefully select your words to tell a patient what the situation is as you perceive, and to give probabilities rather than truths, because there are exceptions to every rule, so they're not really absolute truths anyway. But yet the patient hears what he wants to hear, and therefore is receiving from an absolutist point of view, even though you're talking from a relative point of view. And there's often times that as medical personnel you walk away from a situation saying, I've done everything I can in an honest approach, and the patient hasn't heard anything but one word. He focuses on a concrete word that you say, and goes home and the family says, what did the doctor tell you? And he says I'm going to die, you know, or says I'm going to live. You know, you got a 2% or 5% or whatever, whether we're dealing with hope or reality. And of course, I think we're all like to leave a trend of hope within there. There's always a thread that is running through, and allow the patient to interpret. But they don't perceive what you're saying, and we don't perceive what they're perceiving.
Yeah. I heard a lecture on truth-telling at the medical ethics workshop at the Hastings Center in New York in June, and this guy laid out 9 levels of truth-telling, and what you just said is number 3 level, which he talked about as the whole truth appropriately articulated now. That's kind of what it seems to me you're saying. There are other people who would like to contribute, and I'm sure we could go on for a long time. I have a thing, I guess, about contracting time, and it's 10:15. I think we should formally bring this to a close, and those of you who want to stay around, of course, can do that. Thanks very much.